I'm Dr. Amalia Gonyas-Malka. Welcome to Womanity, Woman in Unity, the show that celebrates women's milestone achievements in their struggle for liberation, self-emancipation, human rights, democracy, and much more. Joining us today is Professor Sarah Krobler from the Department of Industrial Engineering in the Faculty of Engineering at Stellenbosch University. She is also a research associate at Stellenbosch University's Center for Research on Evaluation, Science and Technology, otherwise known as CREST. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Amelia. Thank you so much for inviting me and having me. It's really an honor.
It's a pleasure to host you and to hear more in terms of STEM, but with a specific emphasis on engineering. And thinking about the beginning aspect of your career journey, your academic journey in engineering has traversed the discipline in a variety of qualifications, in electronics, in computer engineering, in technical policy, and working now in the industrial engineering department. What inspired you to pursue engineering?
Well, first of all, I grew up in a house where my father was an engineer. I was exposed to engineering my whole life. I enjoyed maths and science. And, you know, I had actually not at all a clue what I wanted to do with my life. But I also heard that engineering is a very tough course. So I decided for that reason, let me try it. I like a challenge. That's how it happened. I started to study electronic engineering in 1997 and then graduated in 2000. I studied computer engineering, a master's in that. And then I had a lot of pivots and interesting twists and turns in my career between consulting and the academic sector for about until 2015. And then I settled here at the Department of Industrial Engineering. But I have a range of experiences that actually equipped me quite well to be able to do what I'm doing right now.
And thinking about some of those pivots, what was it that pushed you towards academia versus the consulting space?
Yeah, I kept on feeling a little bit dissatisfied in my job. Initially, and I think it's very normal in your first 5 years not to have your dream job yet. But I also noticed in myself that I actually did not really have the skills to make the things work for me and the people around me the way I would like to do it. So I was moving between studying and working about three times. I moved from computer engineering, then I worked at a consultancy. I then returned to university. I did a PhD in engineering management, and I decided that I do not really want to work on computers in terms of programming them. I wanted to use them to solve social problems and look at systems issues. And that is then how I started to move away from being very, very technical and nuts and bolts. After that, I moved to consulting again. And then I got a wonderful opportunity to work with the Vice Chancellor of the University of Pretoria for a year. I did that. So I went slightly back to university. We then again moved. I moved to Cape Town. I joined the consultancy and then I finally moved back to the university. I did a master's in technology policy at Cambridge. And then when I returned, I decided, okay, what do I need more to convince myself that I enjoy a university environment? But all these experiences were incredibly valuable. So it's not like I think I had wasted time, but it was certainly a winding road where I accumulated skills that put me in a unique position to do some research that I hope will have impact.
And that's one of the points that I wanted to make, is that every experience is cumulative. It's not wasted. It may not necessarily be an academic exposure, but it could be a life lesson.
Absolutely, because, you know, if you come from a academic background, especially in engineering, we're not really political animals. So it was a huge surprise for me when I entered corporate that all of a sudden only being able to do the work is not at all enough. And you need to be able to manage up and manage down, and you need to get yourself on a project and all these things. And I didn't know it the first time around, but I quickly learned. And I also learned something really important. Even though engineers are encouraged to, or young people are generally encouraged to focus on maths and science when they enter STEM, the soft skills are the ones that will help you make progress in your career. And that is something that I really want to accentuate, is that even though for engineers those skills may come a little bit later, they are the ones that I think are the ones that will help you make progress, and make friends and influence people, so to speak.
A very important point, and I think that that speaks to other careers too, of having soft skills in place, not just engineering.
Yes, seeing politics in a workplace as part of your job, it's not something, it's not a contaminant. It's just part of how life is, and people want stuff and want stuff from you, but you want stuff from them. And that interplay, it took me a while to figure out.
Everyone has an agenda.
That's for sure.
Industrial engineering, when I was reading up on the topic, seems very dynamic. It involves everything from logistics to analytics to managing people as well as resources. How do you see the field as opening up new opportunities, particularly to young women in the STEM space?
Well, first of all, I think industrial engineering is already very friendly to its female participants, students, or engineers. I think the distribution is almost 50% in our course, in our program, 50% female. It is one of the more attractive disciplines in engineering. And I think what I find very interesting about it, although my undergrad is not in industrial, is that you do not need to specialize initially in a sector. You do not choose a specific technology where you can get locked into, where you can paint yourself into a corner. Industrial engineering is something that is cross-cutting banks, hospitals, the social sector. Every single organization or system can be improved, efficiencies can be unlocked, and also it is a really rewarding job. It is a job that you can do from anywhere. And especially what I think is useful about choosing engineering is that we do not necessarily have a jurisdiction. In law and medicine, your qualification may not be recognized in another jurisdiction. If you go to America or if you go to Australia, they may have separate systems or different systems. And with engineering, you are actually much freer to choose. And with the gig economy and working remotely, you are in no way locked into an initial decision to study engineering. And that is what I think is good. It sets you up with a way of thinking. So we are systematic. We look at root causes of problems, and that can be, why is the education system failing? It can be, why is this bank system not efficient, or many, many applications. And I think to be really, really critical then about how to find the solutions, implement them, and then there's a host of human issues that I think industrial engineers are well positioned to also work with in change management and these kind of things. So I think it's a wonderful career choice. If I had to choose again, I may have chosen industrial, but I just didn't really know what industrial engineers did. I think a lot of people feel it's a word, but they're not quite sure. And people talk about manufacturing, they talk about these things, but it's not necessarily all industrial engineers do, although it started in the manufacturing sector.
Staying with this train of thought and thread. So, firstly, you've mentioned the fact that you can pretty much go to any geographic area and you are not constrained to work in these environments. Secondly, you've tapped into the educational sector, the banking sector, manufacturing sector. What types of careers can people look towards if they have an industrial engineering qualification?
Well, initially you would possibly be an analyst kind of role, or they will call you or give you an engineering title, and that will have a lot to do with number crunching, to look at the data, to use data, maths, modeling to improve a system. It could also be more qualitative. But as you progress, most of the engineers very quickly move into a management position where they manage a range of people. So I was very amused initially when I rejoined university and I saw that the industrial engineers had a banner. It said, if you want to manage other engineers, come and study industrial engineering. But yeah, I think the options are that you can be, for instance, some of the private sector hospital chains have an industrial engineer that walks around in the hospital and they look for things that can be made done better. If it's energy, if it's flows in the emergency room, if it's how you decide to procure theater sets for the operating theaters, it's a applied skill set that you can use in all the hooks and crannies of an organization. And the same can be said of somebody who works in a logistics company. They need to provide a compelling offering to the clients, which is cost effective, routing. There are lots of math issues, but there are also change management issues. So those are typically the kind of jobs that I've seen some of my students move into. But there are quite a lot of them that go and work at Allan Gray in the IT, in an IT team that build the back-end systems of a bank. I've seen a lot of students go into consulting. It's like some of the big brand consulting or more boutique consultancies. And what's interesting, I increasingly see more and more students becoming entrepreneurs. And I actually think that is a very important mindset, that we must not raise the engineers to think that they're going to get a job somewhere. Everybody can't start a company. Some people have to work at somebody's company. But I do think if we look at youth unemployment in South Africa, if we look at a lot of sectors under a lot of pressure, entrepreneurship is something that I see happens more and more. And I think it's very encouraging. So it's not something that's going to lock you in to a career choice early on. And I think that is also important. You'll be learning every step of the way, but there will be ample opportunity to pivot as you see opportunities and the market dictate.
Sure, you keep building up on that skill set. And the fact is that we live in a world where job mobility is encouraged and people look for new opportunities. They're not constrained to work in the same organization for their entire careers.
Definitely not. It's not our grandparents' era anymore, the company man or woman. It's now basically a lot of accent on personal journeys and what will be fulfilling to the individual. Of course, we need to fit into organizations when we work for them, but it is quite a trend that a lot of the companies have a policy that you can work from home so many days a week. But also people are also returning to the office because there are benefits to, especially for young engineers, to learn from more established people. It can also be that you're new to a team and you never really get into it because you are not on site and face to face. Because I've seen it here at university, when I speak to somebody face to face, it's just a little bit better.
Back to those soft skills.
Oh yes. And the cues that you won't see on the screen.
You told us about some of the career avenues that your students go into post their qualification, and students and bringing them through their academic stream is obviously a very important aspect of your work. You mentor over 30 master's and PhD students. What strategies do you use to help support and inspire young women? And I'm saying young women because obviously womanity is all about gender equality, to stay the course and continue with their STEM subjects.
That's a great question. And it's something every year when I take in my new intake of master's students, I warned them that, undergrad is incredibly structured. They've got homework assignments, they've got tutorials. When you move to a research master's or a research environment, it's not that structured. So we try to create structure for them by, setting milestones and these kind of things. But it is incredibly difficult, actually, for a young person who's never eaten an elephant, to start to eat a little bit every week and see the end product. If I could draw a graph, on the x-axis you've got time, and on the y-axis you've got what you have to show. And it's for a long time people work, and they don't have that much to show yet, but they are learning. So I think the most difficult part for me is to keep their spirits up. And that's why they must come to the office, because they have a community here. They've got a community of people who are sharing this experience. I have seen students struggle that to study remotely or are very lonely in studying in that way. But we also have a good or well-resourced research group with scholarships. And paying out per milestone is also a good way to help create structure. It's good for everybody, and it's always realistic milestones, or at least that's what we we set out to do. So I try to help students in a number of ways. It's of course by helping them to get structure, to see the vision, the contribution, to do something that is really, really applicable that industry wants. We usually work very closely with industry partners. We don't really have any projects that's purely theoretical. And through that, I hope to create opportunities. A lot of our students have moved into positions at companies through the scholarships that were offered. Engineers are super lucky. I've never ever contacted a company who did not reply and said, "Yes, let's chat." The money doesn't always come, but the chat is always there, and we extend our networks. So the way we are productive is that I work with a network of collaborators, some of them other academics and some of them industry people, and also fantastic colleagues here in our department. And to be productive, there are a number of ways of doing it, and I think to help people contribute in the areas that they specialize in is the most productive way to work together. And that is sort of how we keep up the numbers, but also the quality of the program that we offer.
Well, it sounds like a very practical application, and not just practical application, but one where there are job opportunities to go into. So
Absolutely.
for a young girl who may be listening today and being curious about engineering but unsure where to start, what would you recommend should be her first step to discover the world of STEM and see where she could fit in?
Can I tell you the truth? I had a master's in engineering and I still did not really know what engineers do. So I think being young is it's very, very difficult to make these incredibly big decisions and to be really informed. I brought along a family member to work to talk to all my students. And basically, it was very interesting how they decided on their course. The one said that she was entering food science or engineering, and she wanted to change to food science, but she was just too lazy to change the form. There are really crazy reasons why people study what they study. But let me tell you this, you will not know if it's for you or not when you study. The study part is not the same as the work part. And when you're 18 years old, 4 years sound like a lifetime. But actually, that passed quite quickly, and then you'll have something really solid. So, if you have good proficiency in maths and science, it could be a fantastic stepping stone into anything else. Industrial engineers can do any kind of other jobs. My sister-in-law ended up in team building. She was not doing mathematical solutions. She loves people, and she was working with very big corporates, doing all kinds of programs with them. So To be honest, you will never know what an engineer is doing until you work as an engineer, and then you'll only know a little part of it. So I think one thing that could be prohibitive could be that the costs can be quite high to study engineering. There are ways to get scholarships, and typically the problem is that corporates only give it after 2 years of passing. There's a quite big dropout rate. But I think if you think you could enjoy maths and science, an applied area like engineering is a very solid choice. A general BSc could lead to something, but you possibly will have to go and study something else as well, where engineering will provide you with a professional qualification and you will be able to say, I am an engineer. And I think, trust me, I am an engineer.
I think you make it sound like a very attractive discipline. Early in the conversation, you spoke about using the skill set that you have in industrial engineering to help solve social problems. And I know that you work with a number of different organizations like Food Forward SA and the MIT Food and Retail Operations Lab to help improve food systems and reduce food poverty, which is a major issue. How do you manage to connect, and let's look at this as a real-world example, your engineering expertise with having an impact on these organizations and people?
It happens organically. I was very lucky to be able to visit MIT for 3 months, and my research group at that stage was focusing mostly on access to health and access to education. But I wanted to expand our focus to access to food. So in inclusive innovation, I thought those are the three big things we need in South Africa, at least for the time being, until we expand further. But it's quite a big focus area already. And at MIT, we were starting to look at food banks, and I looked at it was serendipitous that the biggest food bank in Africa is just around the corner from where I work in Stellenbosch. They're based in Cape Town. So I was looking for a project that's going to make a major impact because that's why people go to MIT, right? And they don't have local impact. They've got global impact. And that was super attractive. And then I found this amazing organization, Food Forward, that's very, very progressive, very innovative. And they deliver almost 1 million meals to South Africans every day. So I thought this is a wonderful opportunity to collaborate. And they were really, really open to it because they could see the value that we can bring. And we have about five, six, seven projects running with them or completed. So it happens organically how we build our networks, but it's not completely by chance, right? There's some form of method, although we leave a lot to serendipitous encounters as well, because that's sometimes where the market leads you, opportunity leads you.
So staying with some of the real world work that you do in projects, you have aspects of vaccine delivery with the IKIC project. You have a sustainable tech with the Frugal Innovation project. These are all really diverse sectors that you operate in. What makes a project appeal to you? What makes a project tickle you and say, yeah, this is one I want to go for. And also, how do you ensure that there's gender inclusive innovation?
Well, I have to say, within our program, through work that we've done earlier in access to health, we got an opportunity to, or the our project partner from Belgium approached us about a project that they wanted us to test the technology in South Africa. So it was through earlier funding that we had through a major pharmaceutical company. And we got to know people through that connection. And that is why the iKick project came our way. But it was not completely unrelated to what we're doing. I pulled in some logistics experts from our department because some of it was about looking at the total cost of ownership of vaccine carrier technologies. And we needed people who can help us to understand the logistics elements of it. So the way we managed to work on a quite broad range of topics, but still try to keep it within the aims of access to food, access to healthcare, and access to education, is I'm not scared to take on a project. I've got a university plus MIT, plus University of Groningen, plus of people with skills that I can involve. Of course, the honeypot is the money. If you don't have that, it's difficult to engage people. But the point is, if you've got a budget and you've got an interesting project that's really, really going to hopefully have impact, you can create a portfolio of projects out of that. So the iKick project we created, for instance, an outcomes-based model project. How do we create business models or healthcare models in African context? How do we set it up that people don't pay for treatment, but for the outcomes that are achieved through treatment? And it's very complicated. So there's a lot of risk for lots of actors. So it's not happening for a good reason. You pay for a consultation at the doctor, not if you are healthy afterwards. So it's not happening for good reason in some parts of the world. But the other element, sorry, what was the other project you asked about?
So we had looked at vaccine delivery and then sustainable tech with the Frugal Innovation Program.
So the Frugal Innovation Technology project is now not necessarily only about access to healthcare, food, or education, but we are using techniques that we've developed in other parts of the project to build an enormous, well, enormous is maybe a big word, but a very substantial empirical base for analyzing how projects, innovation projects, evolve from initiation to scaling or failing, and to understand the values of death and these kind of things in the projects. So the techniques we've developed helped us to get that project. It's funded through a German research foundation. And now all of a sudden, all these other opportunities pop up. You know, we have access to German professors' insights. We have access to one of the world's most prominent frugal innovation professors. And from there, we have more to offer, hopefully in this area, and it evolves. And we keep on connecting with government actors, with agencies in South Africa who start to notice that we can do analysis on a portfolio of projects. So it's a little bit like a growing organism. Some parts grow, and sometimes you have to cut off a few of these branches because they're not going to lead to another project that's also going to be lucrative, because we need to support students to work on it. But you know, we are led by where we talk to people, interest them, and hopefully make a big, big difference to different parts of our economy.
Turning towards more of a personal dynamic, you're a mom, you're a wife, you're a mentor, you're a researcher, an academic leader. How do you manage to balance your career with your personal and family responsibilities?
Yeah, that is definitely, I think, one of the reasons I always take on any invitation to talk to young women, because I think it's one of the biggest questions women have about careers is, will they be able to have a family life and a career and be happy and not neglect? Well, I think a lot of it has to do with what you have at home. So your choice of life partner will determine an enormous part of that answer. So I'm very lucky to have a husband where we have a 50-50 partnership. He's super involved, Dad. I mean, he supports me, so he supports the family, but as I try to do the same, of course. And I think that is where these things become possible or not so possible. The second thing in my life that happened was that I did not have kids very early on. So I was in a position to delegate a bit more. And I have this network of collaborators that I've been able to build up over time. And especially my female colleagues said, please just be on maternity leave. We'll take care of these students. I still couldn't help myself to check in a little bit, but we help each other, and the male colleagues are also very supportive. Most of my male colleagues are fathers that are very involved themselves, but I think balancing things is I suppose not always possible. You have to prioritize at times. And then I suppose that whole thing of is it a glass ball or is it a rubber ball? Which ball can you drop? And to move a meeting to tomorrow is maybe a rubber ball that I can't make any today because my child falls ill. But the family and health are the glass balls. So we try to keep them in the air, and we have backup. We have backup at home. We have backup at work. It is not something I do. It's something we're enabled to do. And I think that's the answer. It's not one person doing all these things. It's really through being enabled by a lot of people.
And you've cultivated a support network, and people understand because they also have similar experiences and similar needs.
Absolutely. And that is something I find incredibly, incredibly important. And it was not always there to have a very supportive and friendly work environment. You cannot be creative if you are in an environment where there's unnecessary stress. Of course, every work environment has pressure, but pressure is not stress. Stress for me is when things go wrong. Pressure is okay, we have to get stuff done. And I think that's the most important thing is we can only attract the best people to our organizations when we pull people up. It's true for any kind of environment. If you can pull people up, they'll come to you. And then if you've pulled them up, they can help you do the work. So it's not like I think if you try to manage so many different roles, you cannot be the kingpin and everything is just about yourself. People that do that, some people have that style. Universities have many kinds of professors, but out of self-preservation, I'm definitely not going to pick that one.
You've got a lot of connectivity in in the different threads of your life that have been woven together. Thinking back to the past, when you were growing up, can you share some pivotal moments which have had a big impact on you?
I think my first pivotal moment was that I really, really, really wanted to read, but I was like 4 or 5, and my grandfather taught me to read. So I think that is where I could start to help myself if I wanted to do something. Because until you can read with comprehension, everybody has to do everything for you. And I was a bit of a bookworm, but also I loved sports and things. But especially in my early years, I was just with my nose in a book. I still did sport and played the violin and everything. But I think the pivotal element for me was to learn to learn. And the moment I started to write tests, my mom showed me how to study. And if you know how to study, you can help yourself. So I think that element of enablement, of reading, knowing how to study, was really important. And then later in my career, sometimes frustration led to me leaving some environments, but also recognizing my weaknesses. Because you end up in a role or in a position because of misunderstanding what you'll be doing, or not yet quite equipped to do the next to go to the next phase. And learning and studying, especially formal study, was my way of coping with it. It does not mean it's the only way. A lot of people do informal learning, read very broadly or discuss topics. I mean, there are many ways of learning, but for me, every time, especially after my initial studies, every time I left something, it was out of not feeling 100% utilized, but then going back to try and get those skills that I can be utilized in the way I would love to be now.
We've talked about these connections. We also talked about support. Have you had any strong female role models in your life?
Well, first of all, My grandmother, she was, I still think if she lived today, she would be the CEO of a very big company. She was a wonderful public speaker. Really, she would even do the prayers in church sometimes. So she was a really, really dynamic person, and she was involved in so many organizations and things. And I was inspired by how involved she was in so many things. That was amazing. And of course, my mother is a studied maths, so they all influenced me to value maths and science. And then when I started to study engineering, I noticed in electronic engineering not a lot of women, but there were two female professors. The one is Lisbeth Botha, the other one is Trudy Joubert. And I thought, wow, there are women that are professors in engineering. And actually, of all the things I want to do, maybe I want to do that one day. But then you get sidetracked with all kind of other career ambitions. But eventually I returned to something that I actually admired a lot. And also the way that they were opening up. We can ski in their wake at the moment, you know, we can slalom in their lake, in their wake. Whereas I think it may not have been that easy earlier on.
That role modeling effect is so important because if you can see it, you can believe it.
That's so true. And I think especially for young women that want to see that they can have it all, it's important for us to tell our stories if you to some extent have some of it. So I think for my female students feel relieved to see that I can go to my son's rugby match 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I'll catch up tonight. But actually, it's a reassuring thing for women to know that they can have a family, they can have a career. They must just choose a husband that will support them. That is my biggest advice for them.
Staying with that note of words of advice, as we close off today's conversation, please share
Yes,
words of
I
inspiration.
have actually thought about it a little bit. So the first thing is that you must never, ever let anybody deter you from studying further. I've had many reasons why people offered it, and one of them could be you're going to be overqualified. Some of it is you won't find a husband if you have a PhD. All these kind of reasons, please don't listen to it. You cannot be overqualified. And if you cannot find a husband with a PhD, that is exactly the husband you don't want. Then the second thing is not to be too scared of the unknown. That is where we will discover new things. So one has to push yourself a little bit. And if you don't like to just jump into, you can tip your toes a little bit, but make sure that you get the courage to try new things the whole time, because that's how you're going to learn and how you're going to get exposure. A third thing is it's not always equally easy to do, but I do think even if you're young, you must not be scared of taking up space. You must go and have your say and take up your space. Don't let people crowd you out or prevent you from contributing, because I think that is super important. If you get bad feedback, think about how you did it. But anyway, the point is do that. And then the fourth point I think is very important. You must dream big and you must work hard.
Thank you so much. I really think those are fantastic words of wisdom and from a learned experience point of view. It's
Thank you so much.
been great to have you on the show and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for inviting me. And I think your show is really an inspiration for many. So I really enjoy to be part of this.
Well, thanks for being part of the Womanity Network. You have been listening to Womanity, Woman in Unity, and we have been talking to Professor Sarah Krobler from the Department of Industrial Engineering and the Faculty of Engineering at Stellenbosch University.